Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, the Iowa legislature unanimously approved a bill to ban most police chokeholds. The legislation also addressed police officer misconduct. It moved very quickly through the whole legislative process in Des Moines. One after the other, the Iowa House and the Senate passed the bills unanimously in each chamber. And after the votes, applause erupted. Now, yesterday on River to River, we focused on improving racial justice in policing in the Cedar Rapids area. We spoke with the chief of police and a city council member there. Also with two African-American advocates, Iowans, advocates for social justice in Cedar Rapids. Kayana Kriva-Levy is joining me now. She's an African-American, also an Iowan. She grew up in Milford in the Iowa Great Lakes region. She went to Okoboji High School, also to Iowa State. She earned a bachelor's at Iowa State University in 2018. Kayana, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, what is your reaction to yesterday's action by the Iowa legislature? How quickly it happened after these demonstrations across the country and the fact that it was unanimous in both chambers?
First and foremost, I find the movement of people the most beautiful thing, to see people marching in the streets, to see folks raising their voices to demonstrate their grief and their anger. And so seeing the marching first and foremost is beautiful, and then what comes after that. So seeing the voting being passed unanimously is very powerful in the ways that we talk about when we do protests, that the change does happen, giving voice to the people as you see them marching, and then having it pass through like legislation allows change to happen. And so I'm honestly just excited to see this. There's absolutely more work to be done. Mm-hmm. But it is so good to celebrate in a victory in this sort of sense.
Right. An initial victory, as you mentioned, a lot of work to be done. You, I imagine, have been to a number of protests in the past few days.
Mm-hmm.
You were one of over 500 protesters I saw who marched at a recent peaceful protest in Spencer. In fact, you were a speaker mm-hmm. in a park in Spencer at the end of that march. And you shared then how you were adopted at the age of 3 by a white family. You recalled instances of racism throughout your childhood to this crowd of hundreds. And when you looked out at that crowd, for those who don't know, Spencer is over 95% white and less than 1% African American. I looked that up. So almost all white faces when you were looking out and speaking, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was the most important messages? What were the most important messages you wanted to deliver to that crowd of fellow Iowans?
So the conversation about racism changes depending on where you live. And when it comes to Northwest Iowa, more so specifically, my main concern with approaching a more white crowd is how do we talk to people and how do we tell them to care very intimately and deeply about race? Because racism affects both Black folks and white folks in real severe ways that involve a lot of consequences. And so the allusion that I like to make, and this is one in which when I was at a protest in Des Moines, we were approached by police in riot gear and talking about how riot gear escalates violence. And so you see a uniform of all black, the face shield, the baton, and that tells whatever protester that they expect to have violence. And so that's how it escalates it. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about is the invisible riot gear that most well-intended white folks wear. Mm. And so how they equip themselves with notions of peace and nonviolence, and how they equip themselves with notions of just being a curious white person And what, in a sense, this does is they call that progress. And what this progress is progress looks like George Floyd, and progress looks like Sandra Bland, and progress looks like all of the other Black lives lost, as I had mentioned in my speech. And just like having a real critical conversation about what all of that means. So, yeah.
Give me an example. Help me understand a little bit more what you mean by invisible riot gear that we carry around. I am white. What would you expect I might have as invisible riot gear? I'm not really clear.
Navigating racism within Northwest Iowa does not necessarily involve physical harm to my body, but it involves mental harm. So the casual racisms that one has to navigate makes the average day exhausting. When people racially profile folks of color as they are going through stores, as in watching them intently or following them. The personal casual racism that I encounter are people wanting to touch my hair. And although this sounds just like an average day sort of occurrence, when I encounter this from multiple people throughout the day of being like, can I touch your hair? What does it feel like? What is it about? What is it like? Then to constantly navigate that conversation, constantly navigate that space to check people, to do this multiple times throughout your average life of explaining to them, my hair is like anyone else's. You have hair, your friend has hair, but you do not ask to touch your white friend's hair. And so, like, that conversation isn't happening, and that exhaustion for the white body isn't happening like the exhaustion that is happening for Black folks.
How do you react now, being an adult, after years of being asked, can I touch your hair? What do you say now?
First and foremost, I would like to say that I am not surprised when people are racist now, because I expect people to be racist, if that makes sense. Where I would much rather trust someone who admits that they are racist than someone who is not. And so when I encounter it in my daily life, sometimes I do get angry. I think countless decades past my lifetime causes someone inhabiting a Black body to feel so exhausted. And so sometimes the anger does catch me off guard. But for the average day, as I navigate that space, I try to do it with education in mind. So trying to take on an active perspective, where is this person coming from? Why are they saying this to me? And try to create a connection to help them understand why that was insensitive. And not everyone has the capability to navigate this conversation in the way, because people are tired. And so it really like depends who you encounter. But for myself personally, I try to educate in that sort of sense.
Right. You've taken part in many protests here and expressed at the beginning of this conversation your joy at what seems to be happening across the country and here in Iowa. What are your thoughts about how some parts of the country, in some parts of the country, also here in Iowa, there were protests, demonstrations marred by violence, destruction, looting?
What is really important, and I think what is really frustrating, is that when people talk about looting and vandalism, that takes away from the focus of what these protests are about. And more often than not, this violence is started and escalated by the police officers who are defending the space to still wear their uniform, to take up a space as an authority, and to also take up space as an authority with violence against Black folks. So when it comes to the protests that have been met by violence, I'm not surprised. I'm frustrated, disappointed. There's a myriad of feelings that I encounter, and it is, I mean, right, we're having this conversation right now about please stop being violent to Black bodies. And we then are seeing police use that violence against the crowds. And so I feel like I have every day for my life encountering racism. It's just like, I'm exhausted. And I take a step forward every single day because I want it to be better for myself. I want it to be better for my peers. I want it to be better for the generations who are beyond me. And then I also want it to be better for the people who have put in this work. And I know that a lot of Black lives have been lost to police violence and just violence in general, but to recognize the work that so many before me have done to this very moment, whether that be from slavery to the civil rights movement, like doing it for them. And so even though I'm exhausted, I'm going to take a step forward and do it, even though I do see the violence approaching me, because it matters to have this conversation today.
Kayana, have you ever been treated differently by police, police authorities because of your skin color?
This is a hard conversation in the sense that a lot of people can view this as subjective, whereas unless you are Black, it is hard to explain this sort of behavior when receiving it from police. But yes, I can say that in the sense of I have been pulled over in the past when I had my white ex-boyfriend in the car at the time. And then I've also been pulled over when I've had my three Black brothers and my white mother in the car. And the space that you encounter a cop in matters. And what I will say is that I am Black biracial, and so I'm a lighter skinned person of color. And that means that I have more privilege than my darker skinned people of color. I want to recognize that and acknowledge that as I do encounter these police officers, so they are less likely to enact violence on me. There is still that violence present, but it's less likely than those who are darker skinned POC. So that all being said, when I was with my brothers, who are all Black, when they were in the car with me, I did receive a ticket that day, as opposed to when I was with my white ex-boyfriend, we were let off and I did not receive a ticket at that time. And so it is about the space that you are in, about who you are with, and acknowledging those identities that you carry as you navigate this with the police officers.
And finally, as we wrap up here, Kayana, what are your hopes for this moment, for this movement, and acknowledging that it is an optimistic time, what the Iowa legislature has done, what seems to be happening in the states, also at a federal level? What are your hopes for this moment in time in our history?
Hope is one of those weird words, you know, like, people say, I hope you have a good day. I hope this for you. And sort of what that does is it puts something in the future. And so, you know, the idea of like, I hope to be a better person. I hope to be anti-racist. I hope to not uphold systems that support racism. What I want to say is I am that right now. In this moment, to dedicate to making a change right now in this moment. So I do have hope for the future, and I am being present in the present to make that change for the future. And so as I look across the United States, you do see that with protests, you do see that with people donating, you do see that with people being active in their communities to change this legislature that involves Black bodies. My hope then is that we have a real conversation about racism to end the conversation of people saying that I'm not racist, because we all are. If you live in the United States, you navigate institutions, your schools, your community, your form of like education. All of that is centered on racism and specifically anti-Blackness within the United States. And it means something more to say, I am dedicated to the work of being anti-racist, to acknowledge where I have my prejudices, to acknowledge where I hold racism in myself, and work to make it better, work to be better, because I am going to be better right now.
Let's end it there. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you for relaying your experiences, Kayana Krivalevi. Thank you very much for your reflections
Thank
at this
you.
very important time. Thank you. Okay, a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Important conversation today there with Kayana that took a, that took place a little bit earlier today. Let's try to get in touch with Katarina Sestarek. She's at the State House. Very busy week and a very busy Friday to end the week. We're connecting with Katarina, our IPR's state government reporter. Katarina, are you there? Her service just dropped. I was notified by it. I wonder if Dennis Reese can come on with me to talk a little bit more about the weather. Dennis, you gave such a brief weather update there just a moment ago, and we heard that we're going to be having a new weather pattern coming into our area. It has arrived. It's beautiful out, isn't it?
It's a new, improved. It's a new, improved weather pattern. Actually started yesterday. You probably noticed what a fabulous day it was.
A lot of wind, too.
Yeah, it was windy, but that stopped. I mean, there's very little wind today. We're going to have like a broken record, a repeat performance of this nice weather for the next several days. So it's something to celebrate.
Okay. I think we have Katarina Sestarek now with us. Katarina, are you there now?
Yes, sorry, my service dropped out.
Yep, that happens to the best of us. Let's go right to it. We've got a few minutes before we go to our break. I understand that the governor just finished up a meeting with the Black Lives Matter group.
Yes, so the Des Moines Black Lives Matter group, a few of the activists from the group just had a meeting with the governor and a few lawmakers. They're saying that she sort of committed to considering an executive order to restore felon voting rights. Right now, there's a constitutional amendment in the works. That's a very long process. The activists are saying that this is something they want to get done now because there's an election in November and people should be able to vote. And so they're saying that they have that the governor wants to talk this over with some lawmakers, and then that they have another meeting with her on Monday to discuss language for the executive order. The governor's office has not confirmed any of this yet. They haven't said anything about it publicly.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm remembering right, I mean, this is not a small number. Tens of thousands of Iowans have records would fall into this would be relevant here for this felon voting rights act here or bill. Let's talk about what happened yesterday. Truly historic. I'm eager to hear you recount this policing reform bill that passed last night unanimously by both chambers in such short order. Tell us about it.
Yes, so this is a bill that was brought forth by a group of Democrats led by Representative Ross Smith from Waterloo. He's also the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus. And there's a few policing reforms in the bill, including allowing the attorney general to prosecute law enforcement officers whose actions result in death. And it also bans police chokeholds, except when there's a threat of deadly force, along with a few other aspects. And this is something that there's been negotiations over the past few days. And then yesterday, a bill was introduced and very quickly was passed, debated by both the House and the Senate at the same time and passed. Things rarely move this quickly at the Capitol. And Governor Kim Reynolds was also on the floor of the chambers during those votes, which is also something that pretty much never happens. And so it was just a very, a lot of people called it a historic day. And some of the members of the Legislative Black Caucus said, it was kind of bittersweet because, while they're happy that this bill is passing, it's not the first time that they've brought bills related to racial injustice forth in the chamber, and then those have been rejected. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely something where, they feel that it's something that should have been done a long time ago, and there's still a lot of work to be done, but they are also taking this as, a good sign of things starting to change.
Okay, we'll watch that front. Tell us about the voting absentee ballot bill. That, in my social media at least, has been blowing up. A lot of comment about that. For those who don't know, remind us what's going on here.
Right. So Senate Republicans passed a bill that would prevent the Secretary of State from sending out absentee ballot request forms to all registered voters in Iowa. And that's something that the Republican Secretary of State, Paul Pate, did in this last primary election last week to encourage voting from home during coronavirus. And so the Republican-led Senate passed this bill that would prevent him from doing that in the future. And it was met by a lot of, anger from Democrats, and even some Republicans didn't vote for it because they thought that the Secretary of State did the right thing during the pandemic. And so now the House received the bill from the Senate, and they have a bipartisan compromise over there. So they amended and passed the bill with support from Republicans and Democrats in a way that would allow a group of lawmakers to oversee changes that the Secretary of State wants to make to the election process, but it doesn't outright prevent him from doing that again.
Mm-hmm. And I understand this group of lawmakers that under the House bill would decide it, that's bipartisan. They're both Democrats and Republicans on it.
Yes, but it does have a Republican majority. So would ultimately, at this time, would be controlled by Republicans.
Okay. In this very shortened session due to the COVID virus, I assume a budget needs to make it through, too. What's happening there?
So the House plans to vote on a budget bill today, but as of now, they still don't have a final agreement with the Senate. And there's some interesting debate over the budget bill. The state is going to have, expects to have a lot less revenue than they first thought because of the economic fallout of the coronavirus. And their House Republicans have proposed a mostly status quo budget. And usually lawmakers go in and have like separate budget bills for different areas of government where they detail out all the like line items of the budget, what the money should be spent on. But this time they're giving the Department of Management, a state agency, and so essentially kind of the governor, the executive branch, the power to decide a lot of the details of the budget and also the power to decide how federal coronavirus relief money gets spent. So that's something that the House Republicans are planning to pass today. Democrats think that they're giving the governor too much power to decide those things. And so that's something that will likely pass today. But again, the House and Senate don't have an agreement yet, and that's something they have to get done before adjourning for the year.
Right, right. So that is the next question. They've only been back present in Des Moines for what, a couple of weeks. Any indications when this session means to end?
It seems that some leaders are hoping to wrap it up tomorrow, but there's definitely no guarantee. Those kinds of predictions are often wrong.
Mm-hmm. Also, very quickly before we go, there's also a bill that would protect businesses from coronavirus lawsuits. Quickly, could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that's a bill that passed the House and Senate, and it would kind of lay out a lot of requirements if someone wanted to sue a business or like a nursing home related to coronavirus exposure. It's something that Democrats say that, would really restrict. It would make it really hard for someone to get recourse for, if they got exposed to coronavirus or if their family member did because of the recklessness of a business or a nursing home. Or because proper protections weren't there. And Republicans are saying that this is something that's necessary to reboot the economy and make sure businesses are confident in being able to reopen.
Okay, Katarina Sestarek, we're glad you're there in the thick of it at the state capitol. Thanks for bearing with us on those technical difficulties, Katarina, IPR's state government reporter. Until next time, Katarina, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with the superintendent of the Iowa State Fair Museum about this week's historic canceling of the state fair. And then I'll talk with a Mason City bike shop owner about how nationwide, perhaps you're in on this, bike sales are booming, really booming. We'll talk about it when we come back. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer from Iowa Public Radio News. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, within the past 2 weeks, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana have all chosen to cancel their state fairs because of COVID-19. This week, Iowa followed suit. Now, Nebraska, South Dakota, Kansas, and Michigan have all said their state fairs will go forward in spite of these safety risks. Well, in the undecided category, as of this morning when I checked, fair leadership in Illinois and Missouri are still weighing their options. But let's talk about the Iowa State Fair. It has been canceled only five times in its 165-year history. Let's talk about that history with Jess Rundlett. She is superintendent of the Iowa State Fair Museum, also a longtime Iowa State Fair fan. Jess, welcome to our program.
Well, good afternoon, Ben.
It's sad, of course, to cancel the state fair, and it was not a unanimous decision by the committee. Do you feel it was the right decision?
In light of the current situation and the lessons we have learned from canceled fairs of the past, it definitely was the right decision for the safety of all Iowans.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the other times the Iowa State Fair has had to be canceled.
Sure. So the Iowa State Fair began in Fairfield in 1854 and arrived here in Des Moines in 1886. The first time our fair was canceled was in 1898, and that reason was really twofold. There was the Trans-Mississippian International Expo, a World's Fair-type event held not too far from Des Moines over at Omaha, and also at that time, our state fairgrounds buildings were being used by the military. The fairgrounds was known as Camp McKinley, and the 49th Iowa mustered in for the Spanish-American War at what we know as our state fairgrounds.
Hmm.
They camped in early animal barns by Walnut Street, drilled on the racetrack, ate pork, beans, and nothing on a stick.
Okay, then World War II, we had that. World War II nicks a number of fairs, right?
Yes, in 1942, we saw state fairgrounds in Iowa, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, and Michigan transferred to the armed forces for use for the war effort. Our fair board turned our fireproof buildings here at our state fairgrounds over to the Army Air Corps as a supply depot. And it was what I found really interesting in historical research is the timing of the 1942 state fair cancellation was very similar to the timing of our 2020 state fair cancellation. It was June 1942 when the state fair board announced their decision to abandon all plans for a 1942 state fair. Mm-hmm. They made this choice not only because the fairgrounds were in use as a supply depot, but also to comply with a request from the Office of Defense Transportation for tire and fuel conservation.
Right.
In the times of World War II rationing, it just would not have been wise to provide Iowans the opportunity to use their limited resources to travel to Des Moines. And then we saw that cancellation again in 1943, 44, and in January of 1945, the fair announced there isn't a chance for the fair. If the war ends this year, the board hopes to hold a fair in 1946.
Right. And
of course,
the war ended in May, right? In Europe, in May 1945, if I'm remembering that right.
I believe that is correct. And then we saw in 1946, the state fair came back and held somewhat, it was a bit of a victory fair, but also a centennial celebration for our state. And of course, in 2021, we will be looking to celebrate the 175th anniversary of our state at the Iowa State Fair.
Mm-hmm. What about the Spanish flu in 1918, 1919? That's talked about a lot, of course, because of the current pandemic. Didn't that affect the Iowa State Fair?
It really was a difference of timing with the great influenza. In 1918, our fair was held in August, and the great influenza really hit the state hard in late September. It arrived with troops coming to Camp Dodge in central Iowa from Camp Devens in Massachusetts. And of course, there had been a few cases before that, but the flu really became major in Iowa after the 1918 fair. And then the final wave of the great influenza was in early 1918, and that disease had mostly died down by state fair of 1919.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the last time the fair was canceled was because of World War II, as you just mentioned. This is big, right? This is in anybody's lifetime who is alive today, almost, who has a living memory of the fair. It's never been canceled. What does this mean for you personally as a State Fair fan?
I believe this cancellation leaves a hole in the heart of Iowa and a hole in my heart. I know that I will feel it especially. It'll really become real on Wednesday, August 12th, when we don't gather for the Iowa State Fair Parade in downtown Des Moines. And honestly, I'm not sure what I'm going to do August 13th to the 23rd.
not planned out yet, huh? I suppose, are there ways to celebrate the fair or aspects of it online? I mean, everyone's doing it these days, right?
I am sure that news is yet to come. And I know I personally have started to think about maybe how I might be able to make some copycat fair foods at home.
I understand you are a former competitive baker and, in fact, Jess once won a prize for the most creative use of chicken sausage. Is that right?
That is correct. In my past life, when I was just a young historian, I was a competitive baker at the Iowa State Fair and once won a Weber kettle grill for most creative use of chicken sausage.
Okay, now we are all waiting. What was so darn creative about the way you treated that chicken sausage?
I think what really pushed the dish over the edge was paid fresh sage leaves in butter before frying the sausage. So it added a whole extra layer of flavor to my pasta dish.
Okay, so it was a pasta with chicken sausage, sautéed chicken sausage in butter.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Do you still eat it these days, or is that historic?
I still eat variations of it. I've got two packages of chicken sausage in the fridge right now.
Okay. Jess Rundlett, superintendent of the Iowa State Fair Museum, will let you get back to working on what you're going to do in August, when normally we have the Iowa State Fair over many days. Jess, a longtime State Fair fan, it's been nice talking with you. And good luck finding out how to fill that gaping hole in August in your life and so many other lives.
Well, thank you, Ben, and start the countdown. It's only 426 days until the 2021 State Fair.
Okay, starting now, Jess. Thanks. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this week. Well, have you caught wind of the bike boom? Perhaps you've experienced it firsthand when, for instance, trying to purchase a new bike, or when you've been out cycling and have noticed, hey, there are a lot more people out there on two wheels. Amid this nationwide set of shutdowns from the coronavirus pandemic, cycling has apparently become the outdoors activity of choice for many Americans and many Iowans as well. It's resulted in a surge in bike sales in recent months. The word is that bike shops are struggling to keep up with demand, also grappling with inventory shortages. Well, let's find out by checking in with one Iowa bike retailer. Matt Curtis is the owner of Wayne's Ski and Cycle in Mason City. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So what has it been like? As crazy as what I've been reading?
It has been. It's, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've never experienced anything like this. The amount of traffic that we see on a daily basis is, 2 to 3 times what we would typically see. Sales are 2 to 3 times a normal, sales volume. Our repair department is just turning over bikes like we've never seen before. So it's been crazy. It's been fun. It's been challenging for sure to get product. We're having to do business a little bit different, working with our vendors and our sales reps to make sure we keep our shelves as stocked as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm. And so, the spring, early summer is obviously the real hot time for bike sales here. So you've been going through inventory 3 times the amount that you normally do at this time. Is that close to your yearly sales total?
Yeah, we're definitely approaching. I haven't done a report here in the last day or two, but we're probably right at total number of bike sales that we saw last year were within probably 4 or 5%, I would say, at this point.
Wow. And it's only June. And you're hearing this from other bike shop owners, the same sort of pandemonium in a good way?
It is, yes. It is good pandemonium. It's fun to see, you know, new faces coming in and trying bikes and getting into the sport. Hopefully something that will, you know, carry forward into the future, and they'll stick with it and become their new normal.
Right. Get off the couch. Get away from the screen. Get out on a bike. So when you talk to customers and they're coming in, do they reference the COVID pandemic and wanting to get out? How do you know? Do you have an idea what's driving this based on conversations?
Obviously the COVID discussion comes up, but usually it doesn't seem that it's driven specifically from that. But I think we all know that is what's behind it. People, aren't, T-ball and baseball being delayed or canceled, and, families just not chasing their kids all over the place. They've had to find new activities to do as a family, and for individuals, with the gyms being closed, I think that was the big thing that we saw first was, that we had an unbelievably nice spring, the nicest spring I think we've ever seen here for cycling. And that really helped drive a lot of it too. If we would have had a very wet, cold spring, I think we would be having a different discussion right now. But, when the gyms close, people could actually get outside and walk and ride bikes.
Have you had trouble keeping your inventory up? Are there things that are just gone and not available?
Yeah, there is. There's certain segments. The biggest area that we've had the hardest time with is mountain bikes, and that's industry wide right now. That price point mountain bike, getting people into the sport, industry wide is just near impossible to get. We have a lot of those on order, and we will have more coming in, but they're just slowly trickling in, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and these are people from the Mason City area, or do you have people coming from farther away?
No, we've definitely seen customers coming from quite a ways. We had somebody from Chicago last week. We're very consistently seeing customers from either Minneapolis or Des Moines.
Why would people come all that way? I mean, I'm sure you've got a great bike shop, but Chicago and the Twin Cities have great bike shops. Why would they come all that way?
Yeah, there's some bike shops that I was just talking to one of my sales reps that, there's some bike shops that have closed for a week at a time because they're pretty much out of inventory. You've gone into bike shops that only have maybe, 5 or 10 bikes on the sales floor. So depending on the area that you're in, you may just not have the selection to choose from. Sometimes it's customers looking for a very specific bike that we happen to have, but we have a website that customers can shop and click and see what we have in stock and purchase from our website. So we've been seeing a lot of that. We don't ship bikes, but so they have to come to our store to pick up bikes, but they can purchase off our website. So we're having a big increase in that traffic as well.
Yeah, I wonder too if you have to give some extra instruction, because you mentioned that these are some of these people are, well, maybe they rode a bike years ago, but need sort of an update on safety and so forth. Do you find people needing a little bit more instruction when you recognize that they're getting on the bike for the first time or for the first time in several years?
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. We've had people that we have to remind them it's just like riding a bike and kind of get their confidence back up. And so far, I haven't had anybody that hasn't been able to, fortunately. But, there's definitely been some timid customers that weren't so sure that they wanted to do it. But I tell you, once you see them roll off and they have a huge smile on their face, it brings back a lot of memories for a lot of people, a lot of childhood memories.
Right. Okay, say Matt Curtis. Yeah, Matt Curtis, what do you see going forward? Do you see... have you seen a tapering off since this started? I imagine it started back in March when our COVID pandemic really got serious, huh?
It did. The first couple weeks was actually a big decrease in store traffic. And then it was almost like a light switch went off. We saw almost overnight, we had people got very comfortable with what was going on, and, you know, found their new normal, and they were starting to come in, and our store traffic increased, our sales dramatically increased. And since then, and, you know, for us, we refer to it as every day like a Saturday here. You know, it's just constant traffic, constant sales.
For someone in bike sales, every day like a Saturday, that's a good slogan.
yeah, it's that's kind of been our store motto. So, you know, we've had to staff accordingly for it. You know, and you know, the inventory is very difficult to you know, manage and try to stay on top of. But I'm fortunate to have a fantastic staff that's, you know, been working extra and going over and above what you would normally expect. And, we were able to stay on top of it. There's a lot of bike shops that are actually turning repairs away.
Yeah, right.
You know, and we're fortunate that we are very on top of it. And at this point, and our turnaround right now is 24 to 48 hours. So,
Matt Curtis, thank you so much for sharing the view from Wayne's Ski and Cycle in Mason City, where you are the owner, and we wish you continued good sales, Matt.
Thank you for having me on.
And we have the weather for biking for sure. Very nice weather in the next few days. Dennis Reese will tell us more about that in a minute or so. Well, at the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River, are you feeling what I'm feeling after another exhausting news week? Well, we have the remedy. It's time for IPR's CC Mitchell to join us to groove us into the weekend. Hi, CC.
Hey, Ben. Good to hear from you.
Well, it's good to hear your voice, and let's hear what you have for us. What did you select to groove us into the weekend?
Sure thing. So I've got two very different checks to share today. So the first of which comes from the latest release from rap duo Run the Jewels. They've just released their fourth record exclusively on digital for the time being. It's called RTJ4. It comes out at a very timely time since its punchy lyrics speak out on police brutality and mass uprising and resistance. So it has a bit to do with the news. But there's also a bunch of fun cameos throughout the album, like Mavis Staples, Zach De La Rocha, and even 2 Chainz on this track I'm about to share with you. So it's a bit unpredictable, very catchy, and with everything coming to light in the news right now, I think that the message of the whole record is definitely worth hearing if you're a fan of hip-hop or rap. So this is Run the Jewels with Out of Sight.
Run. Here come the menaces to sobriety, like what? Super thug is thumping on a cut. Uzi weighs a ton, hit the drum till you hear it go, but I'm a run. Piety just really isn't us. What a rush. See you cutting up a pie, that's my lunch. Run. Yo, pockets when I come, it's an honor to be robbed by Denise's only son. Yeah, give her in it, baby boy, bid it, moving extra heavy, whipping Chevy. Gotta get it, eat spaghetti with the mob. So vegan, people to feed them, cause they don't eat no steak and lobster. Sosa was my hero, honey, Tony's just a
out of mind, out of touch, out of time, man, I smoke a bogey backwards with a...
I love it, CeCe. I had to check, perhaps our technical equipment was malfunctioning, but no, that's part of the rap there. Nice. You got one more tune to take us out for the today.
Yep, in stark contrast to that last track.
Okay.
And the next one comes from indie folk outfit Mount Joy, which recently released their sophomore effort called Rearrange Us. This album clearly takes some lyrical inspiration from some personal heartbreak, but it's actually pretty upbeat and feel good. So I love that sort of contradiction in music, and that this album definitely delivers that. The record deviates a bit more from what we would conventionally think of with indie folk rock, and it's fun and experimental, and it even includes my favorite sad holiday song from this past winter, so it's kind of all over the place, but in a good way, and I think it's really worth checking out. So this track was one of the singles, but is actually the last song on the record. This is Strangers by Mount Joy.
Better not run when I'm blind, 'cause I Okay, they're singing our song, We Are Over, as far as River to River for today. Cece Mitchell, thanks for joining us. Do tune in to hear Cece along with her colleagues, Mark Simmet, Tony Daner. They are wonderful. Your daily soundtrack, IPR Studio One, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock, the best new music and old favorites. Have a great weekend, Cece.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go out with some more of Mount Joy and Strangers. Have a wonderful weekend.